So tonight I want to continue on with the Fourth Noble Truth and what I'm calling it part two. And this is the next three steps on the Eightfold Path. So remember the first two, right understanding and right intention. So we understand why we need to practice. We form the intention to practice in a certain way and move in a certain direction. And then the Buddha says, oh, I guess you better pay attention to how you live your life in the world, which is not maybe what we were expecting. You know? But it's like, it's really clear that what he's saying is how we live in the world sort of sets up the space, creates the calm, still container in which we practice. On one of my long retreats, one of the teachers said something that's always stayed with me forever and ever since then. At the time, it really struck me. And on retreat, basically, there's three things you do, right? There's formal sitting practice. There's formal walking practice. And then there's just stuff you do, you know, walking to and from meals, taking a shower, going for a walk, eating food, brushing your teeth, this stuff you do because you're living your alive being, right? And often people consciously or unconsciously sort of prioritize things and say, you know, what's most important is the sitting practice, then the walking practice, because it's sort of more like just, you know, walking, right? And then it's all that other stuff you're doing. And he said, no. Actually, it should be exactly the opposite. What's most important is just the day-to-day stuff you're doing while you're on retreat, because that's the most like life in your day-to-day real life. And if you can't practice in that space, but if you can't keep continuity of practice, if you can't keep mindfulness in that space of just walking to the dining hall or standing in line to get your food or whatever it is you're doing, that's what's most important. If you want to, especially on retreat, if you want to have a practice that's continuous, like really, like you wake up and you practice all day and then you go to sleep. Some people say you practice in your sleep. I'm not big on that idea, but then a lot of the day is spent just doing this stuff, right? Washing your face, whatever it is you're doing. And that's when we're most likely to space out and not be practicing mindfully, because we very quickly fall into habitual patterns of operating in the world. And I think that's why the Buddha puts this here in this sequence. We have right understanding. We know why we want to practice. We form the intention to practice. We're setting off to actually practice in the world, practice. And he says, now let's pay attention to how you live in the world. And so the next three steps on the path are, I've called them wholesome speech, wise action, and conscious livelihood. I'm very consciously not using the word right all the time. You know, right speech implies sort of wagging finger, you know, better do that. So let's look at these three sections. First one is wholesome speech. The Buddha put incredible emphasis on speech. I mean, first of all, it's a separate thing amongst all the things we do in our lives. Speech is the most likely place where we're going to not be mindful and get into trouble because we haven't been mindful. And not only here, but also in the what's called there's another teaching called the 10 unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind, another famous teaching. 4 of the 10 are about speech. More about speech than action or mind. More about, you know, moving around and doing those sorts of things, or more than what's the content of the mind, what you do with your speech. So I think it's worthwhile to really look at this and see where the places we might potentially be not so mindful. First, obviously, the obvious one is not telling the truth. And this is tricky. It's trickier than we think. You know, it's like we get into these cultural issues of on both sides of this. Not telling the truth could be, well, you know, we'll just tell this little white, what they call a white lie, right? It's not a bad one, it's a white lie, right? A little, just sort of smooth things over. And there are times, actually, I think, and this is important, that that might actually be skillful. There are times, dealing with someone who's really upset, for instance, where, you know, we say, well, but no, it's okay. When actually we know clearly it ain't okay, but we're saying we're trying just to calm them down and mellow them out. So maybe at that point it's okay to say, no, everything's going to be okay. So it isn't black and white, this one. Even at the level of telling the truth, most of the time, 99% of the time, it's much more skillful to tell the truth. The problem with not telling the truth is once you tell one untruth, then what often happens is some situation arises and now you have to tell a second untruth to cover up the first untruth and so on and so on. And all of a sudden, then you're saying, and you told this person that, but you told this person something different. And then, so now you're into, and this is like, can be quite distressing. I mean, the mind's caught up in all of this stuff about, oh, I told this person this and this person that, and what about this? And what, you know, it's a agitating energy. Whereas if you always tell the truth, there's no agitation. And it's like, I don't have to worry about anything. I don't have to worry about anybody finding out anything. I don't have to worry about anybody finding out that I haven't been truthful. And it's like, it's quite calming to be truthful. It's also a huge gift you can give other people to always be truthful. If people know that, then it's like, they don't ever worry about you having some hidden agenda. Some, you know, it's like, oh, this, I can be around this person and I know whatever they say, then that's what they actually meant that. Okay. So that's not telling the truth. First of the four. Second of the four is harsh speech. This is one that, depending on your nature, may be a bigger problem or a lesser problem for you. For me, this is, in my life in general, has been a big problem. I grew up in a family, in a military family, and like, it just sort of, you know, things were like loud sometimes and forceful. And it was the nature of the community I grew up in that harsh speech was like considered good. It's like, okay, we're going to get this guy and we're going to put him, straighten him out, you know, rah, rah. The problem is that when you speak harshly, it's really often quite harming to other people, the people you're speaking harshly to. It's distressing. It's upsetting. It creates unpleasant energy in the field of the conversation. And I for me personally, I would fool myself into thinking, well, sometimes you got to do this, right? My classic one for me is I'm on the phone talking to some support person and not getting the result I want. And I bark. It's so easy to go there because it's like, all right. And then you can hear at the other end of the line this sort of pause. I mean, you sort of feel that the energy of the conversation just shifts just like that. And sometimes you have to, when you're dealing with people in that sort of role, I mean, I have recently, as a matter of fact, said, actually, I'm sorry, this isn't working out the way I wanted to. Can I speak to your supervisor? Without being harsh and saying, it's not saying you're doing anything wrong. It's just, this isn't working out the way I wanted to. I need to speak to someone with more authority. And you can do that in a polite and friendly way instead of barking. And it's okay. But we have to be careful about this. This is the place where it's so easy to get into, where we see it a lot these days, of course, is online, where people online, it's like, forget it. It's like people rant and rave and call each other names and all those things that people do. And it's unpleasant for everyone concerned. So, not telling the truth, harsh speech. The next one is interesting, gossip. Gossip is so juicy. When we gossip, what we're trying to do is make ourselves look important. I know something you don't know, and you're really going to like to hear what I'm going to tell you. So it's like, it's a way of it's self-aggrandizing. And it's always, always harmful to the person you're gossiping about. Either very directly or indirectly, but it's always harmful. But it's more, and that concerns me, but it's more the energy of why we're doing it in the first place that I think we have to be concerned with. It's like, it's trying to make ourselves look good, trying to make ourselves feel important, trying to be the one in control of the process, trying to, whatever that energy is. It's just always harmful to ourselves and to the other, and to the poor person who you're telling. They might not want to hear this at all. They don't want to be involved in this whole thing, but now they've been told. So now that, and then you say, oh, but don't tell anybody I told you, right? So now they're involved in it, whether they want to be or not. So you're creating more layers of harm. Gossip. And then the Buddha, which I loved how the Buddha does this sometimes. The fourth quality was useless speech. You think, what is this? When I first read this, like, what do you mean useless speech? He says, think of all the times you're in situations where you just find yourself babbling. It's just like you're trying to fill in the space of dead air by just saying something. And this is often, by the way, when we say things that are really not very skillful, because we're caught in the discomfort of nothing, no conversation going on, or other people are talking about things that we don't know anything about, but we want to put something in there. And so we end up doing a lot of harm sometimes with useless speech. And also, it's just speech uses up a lot of energy. And not speaking can actually be quite calming. That's why silence is such a big thing on retreat. Because when we can really be in a space of silence, it's just like, it's so relaxing to not be required in any way to speak. But if you start looking at what you say, if you could actually record everything you say in a day, how much of that would be useless speech? It'd probably be pretty shocking if you started to look at it. And it's just, we're filling in space. It's this really blah, 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 blah. My father was a wonderful man, but he couldn't stand silence. If, you know, we're at a dinner table or something and there was nothing going on, everybody was just sort of quietly eating or whatever was going on, whatever we were doing, he'd have to sort of start to get something going. He couldn't stand the silence and stillness. It just was against his nature. And it, sometimes it's nice. I mean, I love being with people and not talking. Like just sort of going for a long walk. And maybe, you know, you walk for an hour and you maybe say five sentences in that hour. Perfect day as far as I'm concerned. It's just so sweet to have that sort of quiet space. But that means we have to watch ourselves and how much of this we're saying is just useless. And go, oh. And I'm not saying we shouldn't sometimes, you know, politely respond to people. I'm not saying sometimes there are social situations where you have to speak. You know, you're just being introduced to somebody and you can't sort of stand there mute and say nothing. You know, but it's like there's lines we have to watch. You know, you're just being introduced to a new in-law. Well, you better talk to that in-law. You know, you can't ignore them completely. But it doesn't mean you have to talk to them for an hour or 2 hours or however long. You know, it's just like you have some, you can set some parameters around this for you. And it's just a matter of looking at it and seeing how things go. So this is what I've just done. This is one of the classical ways that speech is talked about. But I want to read a little something from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness, here. Here's another way the Buddha talks about speech. And this is putting, instead of, this was all like, in a sense, in the negative context, this is with things you don't want to do. What if we turn things around and think about what it is we should do? How can we put this in a positive context? Bhikkhus, possessing five factors, speech is well spoken, not badly spoken. It is blameless and beyond reproach by the wise. What five? It is spoken at the proper time. What is said is true. It is spoken gently. What is said is beneficial. It is spoken with a mind of loving kindness. So this is a slightly different list, right? There's some, you can see some of them are just the opposites, but this is an interesting list, I think. It's when it's spoken at the proper time. How often have you caught yourself saying something to someone and then realizing, you know, they were like caught in the middle of something else. They were thinking, and you just are interrupting their process completely. You didn't wait for the right time when they were like receptive to what you're about to say. If someone's not receptive and you say it anyway, it's like, you know, throwing it out into the wind and seeing what happens. So the looking for the proper time to say something can be a skill that we have to develop. We have to go, oh, yeah, maybe I don't need to say this right now. Maybe I can wait and let speak about this later. Then it's true, it's spoken gently. But then it said, what is said is beneficial. This is sort of the opposite of useless speech, right? But it's an interesting way to say it. And then the last one is, it's spoken with the mind of loving kindness. Is what you're saying its intent is from a space of loving kindness? You know, because often you can say something that's true, right? But the energy behind that truth, like, God, your hair is really ugly today. Could be true, but it wouldn't be full of, you know, it's not a message of loving kindness behind it. It's like, na 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 na, or worse at times. People sometimes say, well, I had to tell her because it's true. And that what that's really is like, you know, the energy behind it is the opposite of loving kindness. It's like trying to hurt that person. But because it was true, we catch ourselves into thinking, well, that's okay because it's true. But was it said with the heart of loving kindness? That's the last thing on the list. Even if it's true, you're speaking gently. You might think it's beneficial. They should know this because it'd be good for them. It's another rationalization we often use. But if it's not, it doesn't have that energy of loving kindness. So we have to really look at our intention when we speak to see that we have this energy of loving kindness. So that's wholesome speech. It's a huge area of practice that we can actually consciously work at. Okay. Then we get wise action, how we actually act in the world beyond speech, which of course is acting, but this is like in a broader sense. And here the best list I've ever come across is what is called the five precepts. And these five precepts are also taken in a certain way, the first monastic vows. When someone becomes a monastic, the first vows they take are the five precepts. And then, by the way, if you become a full monastic, there's something like 138 precepts or some huge number like this you have to deal with. But the five ones are sort of like novitiate. And also, like when we go on retreat, we take a form of these five vows. But even in daily life, they're quite applicable. And this is, you might hear this here referred to as sila, yeah, which roughly translates in English as virtue. So how can I act virtuously? It's another way of thinking of wise action, act in a virtuous manner. And I'm just going to go through this list because you're probably fairly familiar with it, but first one is non-harming. Just don't cause harm. Well, you know, in the strongest sense of the word, this is like, well, don't kill anybody. Don't physically harm anybody, right? And you could take it on that level if you want. But this is a place where Buddhist activism has really tuned in the area of non-harming. For instance, I own a business. I'm producing, as I'm making whatever I produce, I create some sort of unwholesome, polluting sort of liquid. And then when no one's looking, I dump it in the river. That's harming. It's harming others. And so we have to go, oh, how I act in the world in this much broader sense. It's also, I have to think about, does this harm anyone? And now I'm having to look at literally everything I do. Everything I do. You know, if I buy a giant gas-guzzling vehicle, as opposed to something that is more efficient, or maybe, you know, these days electric or whatever, I have to think, am I harming the world by driving this giant gas-guzzling vehicle? It's not something, but it's like in the context of Buddhist thought, that's where we have to start going, have to start looking literally at everything we do and saying, is this harming? It's like, so it's not simple cut and dried at all. It's quite expansive when we start to think about it and look at all how we live in the world in a very broad sense. Similarly, the second of these is taking only what is offered. Well, on retreat, this means, you know, whatever food's there that day, that's what you eat. Whatever room you're given on retreat, that's the room you have. And so on. It's like you don't expect ever to be treated in any sort of special way. And that's a really good way to think of how we interact in the world on our day-to-day life. How often do we start thinking, why aren't they paying attention to me? Why they should be blah, blah, blah. Here I am standing in line at Home Depot and there's only one cashier and I'm busy and blah, blah. You know, I was caught in that just the other day. I'm standing there and I'm standing in line and there's four guys ahead of me and there's one cashier. And I'm going, what's wrong with these people? You know, I should go find someone. And no. This is what's being offered right now. There's one cashier and I stand in this line. And then I just sort of looked around and, you know, looked at what other people were buying. And, oh, I wonder what they're building. And, you know, I just sort of hung out with what the situation. And then all of a sudden someone appeared and said, oh, you come over here. And they pulled me out of this line into so things work out, you know. But it's like interesting how often we start thinking we deserve more. We deserve something, as opposed to just being happy with what's offered. And once again, in an ecological perspective, you can start looking at this from, you know, do I really need to have all this stuff? You know, for me, being a carpenter is like, gee, do I really need another saw or another this? I mean, I could walk, you know, walking into a tool store is like a candy shop for a kid, as far as I'm concerned. It's like, oh, look at all these things. And it's like, it would be so easy to just go in there and buy some more tools. I don't need them though. So I sort of have to sort of walk through the tools section of when Gotkin's like this. Oh, I'm not going to look. I'll walk by. Okay. And it's okay. And then when I do really need a tool, one of my tools breaks. You know, one of my old saws finally died after 30 years. So I went and bought a new saw because I needed a new saw. But I have one of each of those kinds of saws I have, and that's fine. I don't need two. I don't need three. You know, I don't need extra stuff. And you start applying that to all the different things that you have. Do I really need all this stuff? Can I give some of it away? It's great. Giving stuff away is great. If you ever, you know, look around and go, look at all the stuff I have, just walk around and say, oh, I think, when was the last time I used this? And if it's more than a year ago, just give it away. That's taking what's not, taking only what is offered. I think that's how we apply it in our daily lives. To reduce the stuff we have. And it also makes life much simpler. You don't have to take care of all that stuff now and, you know, pack it and move it around and da, 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 da. It's just simple, simple, simple. Okay. The third of the five precepts is correct speech. Well, we already talked a lot about that. On retreat, as I mentioned, this is what's called noble silence. It's where you don't talk at all. Or you're literally going into a space of not speaking. Very healing space to be in, to not have the social obligation to talk to anyone. It's like, what a relief not to have to talk. Gandhi, one of my early models for living a wholesome life, he was pretty famous, right? He was busy. He was like the main teacher of the leaders of India, and he was like really important, and he was doing things and organizing. Every week, he'd take 24 hours, all day Sunday. He'd go into a room, and he wouldn't talk to anybody for a whole day. No one was allowed to interrupt him. No one was allowed to. He would be in silence. He would read the Gita. He would study. He would rest. And that was how he controlled the amount of speech he had to be involved in. He just said, okay, I'm going to have one day I don't talk. And For us, that might mean, you know, in our culture, maybe one morning, it could be a whole day, but it could just be maybe like a morning where I turn off my phone and just, I don't care if someone wants to talk to me. I'm going to have 4 hours on Sunday morning from when I get up till noon or something like that, where I just don't have any speech. That might be a time when I do a little more practice. It might be time I just go for a long walk. It might be time when I, who knows? But this is a time I set aside to not have any speech. And you could let people know, no sense phoning me Sunday mornings. I don't ever answer my phone on Sunday morning. I'm not saying you should do this, but it's like something to consider if you want to experiment with this idea in a small way. Then we get to refraining from sexual misconduct. This is a touchy one in our culture because our culture has a lot of morality laid on us all the time, you know, that wagging finger of morality. And remember I talked about what I'm talking about today is virtue. And the difference between virtue and morality is do this or else you'll be damned, you'll be shunned, you'll fry in hell, you know, who knows? You know, no one will like you. Could be a variety of punishments if you don't do this. Virtue is more like, here's some practices, see what you can do with them. It's not a wagging fingers. Maybe it's a finger pointing, let's go in this direction. It's a different thing. And you see that most clearly in this precept, where if you look about refraining from sexual misconduct, but put it in the context, particularly of the first three, is what I'm doing harming anyone else? Is, am I taking what isn't offered? Am I going to speak about it afterwards? Am I going to gossip about it? Or am I going to have to lie if someone asks me about it? This is what the Buddha meant by sexual misconduct. He never in any place said anything about, oh, only between a man and a woman, you know, only to make babies, you know, only anything. It was just like, don't harm, take only what's offered. Don't gossip and don't have to lie about it. And then you look at the fifth precept, and this is really interesting in our culture, and I'll refer back to the first fourth one. Not abusing alcohol and drugs that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. Boy, talk about our culture is a big problem. But this is where so much non-virtue occurs in this context. And I want to be honest. The actual traditional precept is to refrain from using alcohol and drugs that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. And I've modified that slightly to say don't abuse alcohol. Because I like a bottle of beer with a meal once in a while. Or a glass of wine. So for me to say the traditional thing would be dishonest, number one. And number two, for me, I have my own line I found where it's like, I can have a beer or a glass of wine. That's it. If I have two, I know I get stupid. I head towards heedlessness. So it's probably been 30, 35 years since I had more than one. And that's fine. But I really actually enjoy having a bottle of beer. You know, I make Mexican food, and a bottle of beer with Mexican food is just like, ugh, how can you have Mexican food and not having a beer? I was like, you know, like be almost sinful, right? But you know, it's like everybody has their own lines here, you know. And so that's for me, that's where I draw the line. I know many people have draw the line quite strictly. And think about this in terms of refraining from sexual misconduct. This means if you're high or your would-be partner is high, stop right there. Because once people are high on alcohol or other, all those other wonderful drugs that are out there, then people start falling into heedlessness. And you're taking advantage of that, or you're letting yourself, you're convincing yourself, well, that's okay. Because you're a little high and your judgment isn't so good anymore. So once again, it's not like you're bad. There's no wagging finger. It's just think about what will happen when you sober up and you go, oh my God, Lord, you know, where we've all been there at one time or another in our lives. I certainly have anyway. And it's just like, we just know that this is not appropriate. The beauty of virtue and the beauty of the five precepts is that these are all practices. And I think this is real. I want to read something else from Joseph here. This is one of my favorite passages. This is from his book, Mindfulness. This is one of my favorite passages. When I read this, I was like, yeah. I really wanted to hear this. It was so much of what the Buddha taught seems so obvious. Don't kill, don't steal, don't harm. Still, as we try to apply and practice this in our lives, we can come to the forward edge of our understanding and commitment. And this edge can be a challenging place to be. One teacher commented that if practicing the precepts doesn't make us uncomfortable, let me read that again. If practicing the precepts doesn't make us uncomfortable, it's probably a sign we should investigate them more deeply. It's like, it's so easy to fall into, oh, I'm a good person, I'm okay. And we don't think about these things anymore. I appreciate this comment because it points to these steps on the path as actual practices, things to understand and investigate in our lives, rather than taking it for granted that we're basically good people and then looking no further. These are practices, which of course, in some senses can be relieving, because if it's a practice, then sure, I'm going to mess up sometimes. I'm practicing, and when you practice, sometimes you don't do so good. And so we also have to be able to go, and that's okay. Yes, I messed up. Understand that, you know, apologize if an apology is necessary. You know, I barked on the phone, apologize. Oh, there I am. I'm going to apologize right away. Or whatever. You know, just be aware that the Buddha didn't expect us to be perfect. He was only suggesting that we work towards perfection. And we're moving in that direction. But not it's not the end point that's important. It's the practice that's important. It's the direction we're moving in that counts, not the end point at all. I want to actually read one little thing here from Majjhima Nikaya as well. And this is, I think, also in the realm of this idea I was talking about practice. This is, he's talking to someone named Kunda about leading a virtuous life. Kunda, I say that even the inclination of mind towards wholesome states is of great benefit. Hear that. Even the inclination of mind towards wholesome states is of great benefit. So what should be said of bodily and verbal acts conforming to such a state of mind? So he's saying, even if we have the inclination, even if we form a wholesome intention, there's great benefit. And then if we can actually continue to act on that intention, then the benefit just increases. But it's the intention. Ah, here we are back at right intention. Second step on the Eightfold Path. If we form the right intention to lead a virtuous life as best we can, that just in and of itself, just forming that intention is of great benefit. Okay. Oh. Last one. This is conscious livelihood. And this is interesting because here the Buddha is saying, what we do in our lives to be able to live as householders is important. You know, it's how we make a living is part of our practice. We can't separate that out and say, well, there's the times when I'm working and making money and doing stuff, and that's separate from everything else. It's like we spend a huge amount of our time as adults working in some way, whether that's working for money or working as a volunteer or working raising children or whatever. You know, there's lots of different ways to be working, right? And so it's interesting here because here, and this is a place where the Buddha got extremely explicit. Often he was sort of like, well, figure this out for yourself and here's some guidelines. Not so with right livelihood. And we got to remember this is what I'm about to read is from sort of 2,500 years ago. So, but actually it's amazingly applicable today. And you can see by I'm going to go through this list of what are essentially called prohibited ways of making your livelihood. And you can see how related they are to the five precepts. I mean, they're very tightly interrelated. But this is an interesting list. There's six things on this list. Trading in weapons and instruments for killing. Wow, because you're encouraging harming, right? I mean, so it's like there's that, you know, slavery, which we think, well, you know, it still happens a little bit. But actually, I have a regular student who actually comes to these things once in a while, but who sits long retreats with me a lot, who's a special force in the Denver Police Force, which is the anti-slavery unit in the Denver Police Force. And you think, Denver? Slavery is like, it doesn't compute in our minds, right? Happens all the time. Right here in Boulder, there are people who are probably enslaved. Often young women, sometimes young boys, sometimes people who are here illegally and made to work in sweatshops or ridiculous conditions. But this is a modern day problem. It isn't just something that I was like, you know, the United States, you know, banned slavery, you know, 150 years ago. We don't have to think about this anymore. It's ongoing right here in our country, in our city. We're just pretty invisible, unless you happen to be on the task force that tries to deal with this stuff. I won't tell you any more stories, but it's interesting. Here's number three. The production of meat and the killing of animals. Wow, that's an interesting one. But he's talking about non-harming. And so he was very precise. I mean, this basically is talking about being vegetarian. It's part of having a conscious livelihood. Sorry. It's a hard one for our culture because we're so meat centric in our diets often. But basically, this is what the Buddha is. It's so if it's not legal to work in the production of meat and killing of animals, that implies consuming them is equally improper because you're encouraging people to do that. I'm not going to go any further with this, but I feel very strongly about this. And it's just, I think it's very clear. The manufacturing or selling of alcohol and drugs that cloud the mind and lead, right? So if you're manufacturing them, you're leading others to cloud their minds. Very simple. Making or selling poisons. Well, what's a poison? I mean, poison is like, you know, we think about poison as like something we put out to keep the rodents down, you know, but there's lots of things that are poisonous that we may not even think of as poisons. You know, is DDT back in the day, you know, before they banned DDT, was poison. It was like killing countless birds and animals and killing the land. But people were making a lot of money making this stuff and selling it. So we start down, so we have to think of what poison means. You know, and some people would be more extreme than me, but everybody has this idea of what's poisonous for ourselves and for other people. So we have to sort of be a little broad. And the last one, this is the Buddha, of course, being his general, now I got to give something that sort of covers everything else I haven't covered already. It says, any profession that involves deceit. Take that for what it means. You know, there are lots of professions, you know, some parts of the advertising world and marketing world are full of deceit. Having been in those worlds in my professional life once upon a time. It's once again, I'll say no more, but it's like, it's an interesting thing that would be on the list, you know, because now this is, and it's directly related to the precept of not telling lies. So those are the things we shouldn't do. What did the Buddha recommend we do? What was on the list of good stuff, right? Two things. Being a farmer and a teacher. Those, because in his culture in those days, those are the two things that were considered always wholesome. Well, that was 2,500 years ago. We can't all be farmers and teachers. So we need to sort of expand this somehow for our culture and our time. And I wrote something down here a long time ago that it still applies. I also want to read this. So we need to approach whatever work we do with an attitude of service. Farmers and teachers are people who serve others. They produce the food people eat, and they teach people. So if we can have an attitude of service as we act in the world, and as I said, this might be like in your professional world, or it might be just you're a volunteer and you do some volunteer work. That's work as far as I'm concerned. And this doesn't necessarily mean that the actual job has to be something like healthcare or social work, which are very direct service-oriented industries, as they are called. It means that everything we do, we approach with an attitude of service and loving kindness. Can I act as I work in the world? Can I, every act I do, have this thought of loving kindness behind that act? And then it doesn't matter what you do, as long as it isn't one of the prohibited ones. Right? It doesn't really matter. Now you can be, you know, this could be, you know, whatever profession you have. You might be considered pretty weird, but and we also have to sort of pause and look at things. I want to tell you a little personal story here. I was at once upon a time, I was back in the 80s, I was in my quote professional life, I was a computer guy. And I worked doing various interesting jobs. And I got this really cool job working for this company that was automating mapping. This is back in the 80s. This is long before, you know, Google Maps and that sort of thing. This is like high-tech cutting edge stuff, basically. And it was really interesting stuff. And I was working for this company on this huge contract for the Australian Navy, for the Australian government, to modify this software to be more precisely aimed at mapping coastlines, because Australia has this enormous coastline, right? And for the number of people there, there's a lot of coastline per person in Australia. And this is back in the 80s, so there was even a lot more. And it was just fascinating technical, you know, working with big flatbed plotters and dealing with odd Australian ways of measuring things. And it was just like dweeb heaven, right? And I was just like fascinated by the whole thing. And I worked at it and spent about 6 months on this project. And then I had to go to Australia to deliver the product and install it in Sydney. And I was talking to one of the guys who was part of this project on the Australian side. And a question came into my mind about, what do you want this for so much? Why is the Australian Navy want this so much? And he said, oh, we have this real problem tracking and figuring out where foreign submarines are hiding in our coastal waters. And if we can more accurately map our coastline, we can defend ourselves better. And I was like, oh, I mean, I was like, oh my God, this is what I've been doing. I've been helping this place make war. Even though it was the coolest, most interesting job, that's part of what sunk into me. And I actually went home and lasted another 3 or 4 weeks in that company, and then I quit. I realized I couldn't do this. This is where this was going. And this is what we have to do. It's like we have to look and say, is this really valid, given how I see life? And this can be a difficult question. Because like I said, this was like some of the most interesting, fascinating scientific programming work I'd ever done. It was really cool stuff. And the project I did before that was helping Zimbabwe map their country, which was like a pretty, you know, building the right software for the internal mapping and all the weird measuring systems that Zimbabwe. This is right after Zimbabwe became an independent country. It wasn't no longer Rhodesia. It was now the black people now controlled the country, and the Canadian government gave them a bunch of money so they could get there, because they didn't even know where the boundaries of farms were. There's all kinds of stuff they didn't know. And they had to map it accurately. And so I felt really good about doing that project. But then the next one came along with, oh, really cool, really interesting, but. So it's the way we have to just think in those terms sometimes. Is what I'm doing useful to the world in that sense, in that broad sense. And this is, you know, the only other thing I want to mention, and I've mentioned this recently, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, is the Buddha never said there's nothing wrong with making money. As householders, making money being having enough money to live comfortably, enough money so that you can, you know, give something, be generous with others, is perfectly okay. We should never for one second think, oh, I should take a vow of poverty and then I won't. No. You know, that's absolutely not necessary at all. it's more about how that money comes to you than anything. Once you have money that you've come to by wholesome and legitimate means, how you spend it, that's just, you know, as long as you're not, you know, polluting the world or doing whatever, to all these other things, you know, you're being generous, you're taking care of yourself, you're taking care of your family, you're not getting, just accumulating too much stuff, you're being generous with it, this is perfectly all right. That's just sort of a summary of conscious livelihood I wanted to throw in there. So in summary, for this whole thing I've been talking about, this is an enormous amount of stuff we have to pay attention to here. This isn't something we can just sort of, oh, well, I'm just going to meditate. We have to look at our entire life, everything we do, and go, is this wholesome? Is this useful? Is this skillful? And that has to be the criteria we may use to make decisions in the world. That becomes the top, at the top of the list. Is this wholesome? Is this skillful? Does this lead to more suffering or to less suffering in the world or for me? And let that be the main criteria when we start making decisions. And we have to understand, I just want to repeat this, that these are all practices. This is all practice. This is practice in the world. People ask me about practice in the world. This is what the Buddha meant when he talked about practice in the world. It wasn't some special technique or trick. It was like, just look at your life, all of it, without exception. I want to read a little bit of a poem here at the end. This is from Mary Oliver's book, A Thousand Mornings. And it's a little section from a larger poem called I Happen to Be Standing. That just when I read this, I was like, oh yeah, okay. I know I can walk through the world along the shore or under the trees with my mind filled with things of little importance, in full self-attendance. A condition I can't really call being alive. I'll read it again. I know I can walk through the world along the shore or under the trees with my mind filled with things of little importance, in full self-attendance. Attendance. That word is great. Self-attendance, paying only to attention only to myself. A condition I can't really call being alive. Yes. Thank you, Mary Oliver. I think that applies, sums up everything I just said in 8 lines of poetry. So, okay. So that's all I have to say. So now I am going to turn this over to you folks. And if you have may the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.